Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of About Abroad, where it's my job to introduce you to people who have built amazing lives for themselves in various foreign corners of the globe. We're talking with expats and thought leaders about moving abroad, remote work, visas, and all the fun and practical knowledge that you need to know to follow in their footsteps. If you've ever dreamed of making a life for yourself overseas, maybe working remotely or embracing long-term travel, retiring or studying abroad, or even just taking a peek inside life beyond your borders, you've landed in the right place. This episode is brought to you by my friends over at My Expat Taxes. For my fellow Americans out there, we all know tax season is upon us, and for anyone who's ever had the pleasure of dealing with multiple tax agencies in multiple countries, you know this can be a challenging experience. That's why when it comes to dealing with anything tax-related abroad, I always recommend hiring a pro to help you navigate this unknown space. In my experience, this not only saves you time and spares you from the unnecessary headaches, it also has literally saved me thousands of dollars in taxes over the years. So I am super excited to introduce you to My Expat Taxes, a true pro in this space that focuses 100% on U.S. expat taxes. Whether you're filing for 2023, catching up on back taxes, predicting a future tax obligation for a future move abroad, or just looking for some guidance, My Expat Taxes has your back with speedy and affordable online filing options and real human accountants to assist you as needed. Join the more than 16,000 other Americans living abroad who have used their services by visiting myexpattaxes.com via the link in the show notes. My guest today is my friend Dom Pinto, who joins me from beautiful Madeira off the coast of Portugal. But as we get into very quickly in this conversation, Dom has called a variety of countries home over the span of his life. Today, we're going to hone in on three areas in particular. Of course, his home there in Madeira. We're also looking at his mother country in the south of Italy. And we're going to talk a little bit about Albania and Albania's nomad visa. Dom has been very involved in a lot of government work that to help create digital nomad visas and welcome more digital nomads and remote workers. And he is also the founder of The Great Shift and the author behind the book, The Great Shift, which helps compilate some of his learnings and leadership tactics as one of the leading voices in the future of work movement. Dom shared a lot in this episode, and we're grateful for his time. So please help me in welcoming Dom to About Abroad. So I was thinking back to when you and I first met as I was getting ready for this interview today, which I'm very excited about, by the way. It's been a long time coming. And I was recalling like the first time that you and I met, we actually got placed next to each other at a lunch in Madeira, if I'm not mistaken. And then I was trying to remember, I was like, do you actually live in Madeira? Or is that where you just, is that kind of like a home away from home? Do you have a home? I know you're a bit of a nomad and entrepreneur, but I mean, I feel like that was sticking in my head. I was like, there's a very basic point of this guy's story that I feel like I actually don't know.
No, you're spot on. So we were having lunch. It was a really good lunch. I remember having a really good conversation with Lila, I think, as well.
Yeah, Lila was there with us. Yeah.
It was a good conversation. Yeah, I am based in Madeira. I came here almost 3 years ago, and I really fell in love with the place and the community and the people here. And I really enjoyed it and stayed put. The best definition I can come up so far is that I'm a slow nomad. I've always had a very interesting consideration about the word home. It's one that I struggled. I grew up in Germany. I was born there. My parents are Italian, so automatically where your parents are is home, right? But I always felt home was more like Italy. And then there's certain places, and you might be able to relate to this as well, that just feel more home. So Madeira by now feels really like home. Like a few more places. So it is a home. I have an apartment here and everything. I spend a considerable amount of time here. It's not fixed. I would say it's around 6 months plus that I spent here. And then I do travel for work and for pleasure and for projects. So it is home, maybe isn't for some traditional standards and definitions, but in my way of seeing home, it is home.
Yeah, for a lot of people that have been on this show before, that definitely constitutes home. If you have a fixed apartment and a place that you spend 6 months, then I think it defines it. But it is a funny thing that you bring up. Like, actually, it's something as simple as home being a bit of a struggle, right? Like, when we're trying to define, you know, where we come from or where we live, even like this not that long ago was something that only a very small fraction of the population would have any trouble coming up with an answer to. And more I talk to people who are like, well, that's actually an interesting question. And so, I kind of find that like fascinating, because there's a lot that we identify with, like when we think about where we're from or where we live. But when that question becomes a little bit convoluted, there's some extenuating, I guess, like implications that come along with that.
Well, and I remember I started dating and I was on the way to Italy and I said, I'm going home. And she was like, oh, you're going back to Madeira. It's like, oh, no, I didn't mean that home. I'm going back home to South Italy. Ah, I thought the other home was Germany. Like, well, yeah, it is Germany as well. And this is how it starts to get complicated. I think it's more of a feeling than anything. But Madeira definitely feels home.
I agree. And I think so. Okay. Reflecting back on something that you said there, you were born in Germany, but your parents came from Italy. Were you going back and forth between Germany, like, and also since you kind of identified as Italian, like, did you spend a lot of time back in Italy, or you were primarily in Germany, but just grew up with this mindset that you're more Italian than German in a way?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. So I grew up in Germany. I was born in Germany. Both my parents are Italian from South Italy, from Puglia. And I grew up there and I went to school there and I did my high school there and I started university there. I did go to international school and I did an EB, the European Baccalaureate, in the Italian language section. So I grew up speaking Italian most of my life, even though I was in Germany. Of course, I would also speak German. It's my second language. It's native, as good as my Italian, maybe a little bit better than my English today. But what happened is I always grew up with Italian community around me during the day and at home. And outside of that, I would be in a German community or multi-nationality community. It always felt Italy was more home than Germany. And I would spend most of my summers, all of my summers, with my grandma in South Italy. And that's really what I would look forward to do the whole year. And whenever I could, sometimes Easter as well. But that just started later on. Yeah. And then later on, I started living completely abroad, away from both countries.
Yeah. And I saw something on one of your websites or somewhere I read that you've been to like 40 other countries now, and you've lived in a handful of them. Obviously, you're living in another one now there in Portugal, and then you have this like affinity with Albania as well. I feel like you've got roots, some sort of roots in a lot of different places. And for someone that loves to travel and explore and like adventure around the world, I mean that sounds very appealing. Is it the lifestyle like you designed, like intentionally? Did this just happen? Like, I think this is fascinating because like you're a pretty busy guy. Like if you look at all the things that you're involved in, like you're doing quite a lot, and travel and living abroad and, you know, transitioning from country to country can become like a second job in and of itself. So I'm kind of curious if this like, you know, you created this by design, or did this just like sort of happen? And in either case, like how does that happen for someone like yourself?
You probably have 4.5 questions in there, but I'll try to start and tackle one. It was not by design initially. It was by design in the second stage. So I went abroad by design or by choice. I didn't quite find myself in Germany. It wasn't really my place. It didn't feel like that's where I belong. And then I went to study in England, I went to live in Dubai, and then went back to Germany for a small stint, and then I migrated to Australia and I lived there for 9 years. So the living abroad was always a choice. I always loved the idea of going back to Italy, but Italy didn't seem to offer a lot of opportunities. Remote work wasn't really a big thing back then, so I looked for other opportunities and went to Australia. Now, when I came back from Australia to Europe, when I made a decision, initially I was just going to go to Madrid I did my global executive MBA in Madrid, so I thought I really liked it. Why not start over again there? But while COVID happened, I started thinking like, well, do I have to decide where I go right now? My work by now is remote, or at the moment is remote anyway. So I just started traveling. And from there, I started enjoying different countries. And then I decided, actually, I'm quite location dependent. I don't have to stick with one place. And then the rest of it just happened more or less by just referrals, inertia, having good conversations like the one we had for lunch that, you know, in the end, I'm here now. And the same happened with Albania, for example. I was invited to do a keynote there, ironically, about wellness and health while being a nomad and traveling. And from there, I really enjoyed it and stayed there. And it's one of those places that for me feels like home. So I go back there and I integrate almost immediately because I know where to go, what to do, what the culture is, and how to be part of it. So one thing leads to another.
It's funny. Now I asked four questions. You gave me answers there that made me want to ask like it's like a multiplier effect. Now I have lots more questions. I always think it's funny how this happens. Albania is very interesting because this is actually what we spent a lot of time talking about this when we were hanging out there in Madeira last year. You had at the time, if I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're getting ready to run some sort of like digital nomad village there in Albania, something with the government. And like, there was this idea of Albania attracting more digital nomads and you were at the, you know, right there in the center of all that. Can you kind of like refresh my memory? And then it'll be like good new information for the audience.
Of course. Well, what happened, I really get along with a lot of people in Albania, especially at government level. And what we started to do is started to get more and more invites to come and speak at events, on meetings and gatherings, panel discussion, podium discussions, fish bowls. And from there, the Minister of Entrepreneurship at the time asked me as well some ideas on how to make the digital nomad visa for Albania the best digital nomad visa. And I remember this conversation like, well, what are some of the best ones? And looking at Europe, we looked at Georgia and looked at how the bureaucracy there is quite easy. The tax laws is easy and it's easy to understand and get behind. And she asked me like, well, how do we beat them? And that's probably how I started getting involved in some projects. And later on, I was approached from a hotel owner that read one of my posts on LinkedIn and said like, well, I have an hotel here. We are usually very empty during the winter season. Most of the tourists come in the summer season. What could we do? And the idea was that it's quite early until all the visas are done and everything. But we have nomads already traveling and spending some time there. And while it might be early, it might be a good way to do a trial and run a pop-up using the hotel as a base and see what happens. And in fact, we did, and we had a few nomads going there, spending some more time. Of course, off season, it's early days. So it was super interesting to see a location which is just starting out and seeing everything has to be done. So grassroots, basically. And we run a few experience weekends, and those went really well. People came in from Tirana, but also from other places around the world just to experience it before the weekend. And that went really well. And from there, we started having more interest and more interest. At the moment, there are a few more projects that I'm getting involved there. We are in definition of it. One that's it's confirmed is the Tirana Digital Nomad Festival. There was one happening in 2022, and there will be one happening this year in May. So it's a good opportunity to come spend some time and explore the country as well.
Yeah, Albania is one of those, like, I guess I would still classify it as like up and coming. In a way, like definitely not yet peaked on the radar of your everyday travelers. Maybe like some of the more adventurous digital nomads have already gone and spent some time there. But I mean, I hear it almost feels like, you know, like it's neighbor to the north in a way, like Croatia, like 10 years ago or something, where it's like, this is the next place that a lot of people want to go visit. You have incredible coastline, beautiful nature. Very vibrant city there in Tirana and some other places along the coast. obviously, like the prices versus some other places in Europe are make it a bit more attractive. So I think like I feel like Albania is on the brink, if not like already arrived in this way. What's your perspective?
I think you're spot on. So it's not quite there yet in some areas, and it is quite there yet in other areas. So beaches, amazing. The city, vibrant. It reminds me of a very young Madrid when you go back 15 years ago. That kind of vibe that you have in Tirana, for example. Everything is walkable, which is already nomad friendly. It's a great spot to spend some time. It's not quite there yet to be a place to spend a considerable amount of time, like, for example, I'm doing now in Madeira. And that's purely because it's early days. So I remember 2 years ago when I was getting ready to go there for the festival for the first time, people were like, what, you're going to Albania? Are you out of your mind? And I remember my mom, you know, I don't know if this happens with your family too, but my mom is always like, why do you want to go there? It's not safe. And the truth is, it's probably the safest country I've been. I remember Dubai giving me very similar feelings of being very safe. Tirana is even more so. You can walk, you know, walking at nights alone and feeling completely comfortable is one of those markers for me. That certainly is the case in Albania. You can very be relaxed there and nothing is really happening. And so from a tourist perspective, it's already attracting lots of people, mainly from Italy. So you go down there mid-July to mid-September, it's super busy and quite touristy, like it used to be in Croatia as well. Other than that, though, it's still vastly unexplored. And from a nomad perspective, it's a massive opportunity. What's also happening from my perspective, talking about, you know, moving abroad, you know, Bulgaria is now Schengen. So for a lot of countries, for a lot of people with nationalities outside of Europe, can only spend 3 months in Europe. And then we have to look for alternative if we want to stick around. I think Albania is qualifying to be one of the prime destinations for it because they are still outside of the European Union, even though they are in the process of getting there eventually. I think that makes it even more appealing for Americans as well and for people that don't have European Union passports. And you're so close. Everything is so small. You have good infrastructure. You have good people. Food is great. I have high standards. I am Italian after all. But food is pretty good. It's quite affordable in price as well. So you have a good combination of everything.
So if all that's the case, because I agree, like, I mean, I spent a little bit of time there last year, unfortunately, not as much as planned due to a mechanical breakdown on my way there in Croatia. But setting that aside, I had a wonderful experience, loved it, can't wait to go back, spend more time there. And so it makes me wonder, though, like, you know, we have all the information at our fingertips. And like you said, like, it's not quite there, but it's getting there, right? Like, as far as being on the map for people. What's still needed, and is it infrastructure? Is it bureaucratic? Is it just, you know, knowledge, like for the average person to understand the opportunities here? What would make it arrive?
All of the above. So it's infrastructure is there, in terms of like roads, great, right? Public transport, not that much. It's affordable. You can find a way to get a bus from A to B. It still takes a bit of time and it's a bit bureaucratic on that perspective. I'm super fluent in Italian. So for me, being there, it's super easy. I either speak Italian or English, so you're already winning. If you don't speak Italian, English is still good in major cities like Tirana. It can maybe be a bit of a problem. So I think that's just a problem that will be solved over the next years. So it's already in the making, but it's just not quite there yet. Bureaucracy is a thing. So most of us don't really need a visa to go there for a little period. It's very relaxed. But if you want to stay, then it takes a bit of time to get a nomad visa or a remote workers visa. And that makes it a bit bureaucratic. So it can take up to 2 months at the moment, which is quite a bit of time in our world. So that's quite not there yet. And then it is still a developing country. So I think it's very easy to misunderstand that, because you go there and you see beautiful nature, you see a nice city, you come from Europe, whether you enter from Greece or other countries, So you're in the middle of the European Union, but it's not quite a developed country yet. So there are a few things that some people might find that it's not quite theirs yet. I think back of how other countries were, you mentioned Croatia or other countries as well, where you heard similar stories 10 years ago and they're not anymore a problem. And I remember being in South Italy as a child and seeing the difference with Germany. They're no longer there. It just takes time to get through the process.
That's a great point. I think it's a fair one too. I struggled a little bit. Like I have a really funny memory/story of drive, because we were driving through Albania. We drove from the north of Italy down to Greece, along through Croatia and Montenegro and Albania, and it was an incredible experience. And I have this like one really funny memory of trying to get onto merge onto a highway, but like the way that you merged on, and this was like maybe an hour outside of Tirana, but like the way you merged on was a very sharp, like steeper than a U-turn to get onto that. And it was coming off of a dirt road, getting onto the exit ramp or the merge ramp to like then get onto the highway. And it was just funny because literally my wife had to like get out and stop traffic, and I had to like pull out, do like a 12-point turn to get back onto the ramp. Anyway, it was just very funny because we were thinking like, this feels like something, a little bit of something out of like a movie or something. Like you wouldn't have expected this because we had just been through Tirana, where it was, you didn't feel any different from any other major European city. But it was like, okay, yeah, this kind of thing's like still developing a little bit. And that, for me, that kind of thing like adds a lot of joy and intrigue to an adventure. I mean, I think there's a time and a place for everyone, but it's, for me, it's a lot of fun. Like I look back at that and laugh. So you mentioned the nomad visa. I actually don't recall, like, what is the situation with Albania's nomad visa? Do you know much about that?
I'll get to it in a second. I just want to comment something. For me, that's the exciting part of being in those countries before we become a big trend, right? So when it's still raw and real. So if that's your thing, I think Albania should be on the top of your list. But not everyone is like that. I have had friends going there. So like, yeah, for me, it's not quite ready yet. So it's in that perspective. The Nomad Visa was launched last year. It's very competitive from my perspective. There are talks of doing some amendments right now. So I don't know by the time it airs if there will be some changes. As it right now, you get a 12-month visa. You get free healthcare. You don't need an address to register for the Nomad Visa, which is always... you don't need a rental agreement or something like that, which is also great. One of the changes I was able to influence. And the tax situation is also quite advantageous. Albania already has a quite advantageous tax situation. But as for my last knowledge, we're going with territorial. So you only pay taxes on money that you make in Albania. So if your income is coming from abroad, it's pretty much tax-free. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, that's... And do you know, can you apply for it there in the country, or do you apply for it ahead of time and then arrive?
That's the bureaucracy part, right? So technically you can do both. Practically, sometimes that can be a bit of a challenge. You go on a link and you click on it and you realize that's not quite working. That's been ironed out, or you email someone and the information hasn't quite triggered yet. The government is super engaged and super young. So sometimes the laws are quicker than the bureaucracy. So that can be sometimes a bit of a challenge. Yeah.
All right, cool. Good to know. Lots of exciting things there. It sounds like major bullet points, they're doing it right. You know, like low barrier to entry, low friction, get people in, let them experience the country. I think these countries, you know, especially someone like yourself, like you've been involved at the government level talking to the people who are creating these, and you hear the push-pull factors involved for them and like what they're looking for, what they're trying to get out of this, what they think is important. And I think there's like two distinct groups. There's like one who just says like, we just want to get the digital nomads in. We want to let them get the experience here. We want them to come and spend their currency here in our country and you know, pump revenue into the economy that way. And then I think there's this other that's like, let's see how we can take advantage of this situation in terms of generating income taxes. And I think that latter group really struggles. Like, I don't talk to many digital nomads, even with some of the most popular countries out there. Like, I don't talk to many of them who are dying to go enter themselves into the bureaucracy of a foreign country just to go for 1 year. Like there's so many options out there. I feel like that's a deal killer for a lot of people.
And the irony is very often a lot of country on the setup that have all what it takes. I look at Italy, my home country, they've passed a number of laws that are very attractive for nomads. But even there, you don't want to deal with the bureaucracy. You're like, okay, maybe I'll just stay somewhere else and pay more taxes because I don't want to go into the bureaucracy of it. Or sometimes you save on taxes, but then doing your tax report will cost you so much money that you might as well pay taxes. So it's this complete, you know, confusion a lot of times.
We'll be right back to the show after a quick break for a note from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you in partnership with my friends over at Lamont & Co. If you're planning a retreat, offsite, or group gathering of any kind this year, I highly suggest tapping into their extensive knowledge and experience to help you find the best possible venue for your event. I work with Kim, who has become my trusted advisor when it comes to planning any event around the world, and she's literally saved me hundreds of hours of work and has located venues I never would have found on my own. She even provides me with budget breakdowns and cost estimates for each location I'm interested in and negotiates contract terms on my behalf, all for free. If it sounds too good to be true, I thought the exact same thing at first, but I can assure you this is the real deal. Lamont is paid by the venues, not by you, so there's no cost, risk, or obligation here. So do yourself a favor and contact Lamont via the link in the show notes when you're planning your next group, retreat, offsite, or gathering. Before we dive back into the rest of the interview, I have a small favor to ask of the audience. If you are enjoying this episode and getting some value out of it, then please follow these very simple instructions. Step one, pick up your phone. I'll give you a second. Step two, leave a 5-star review for About Abroad. That's it. That's all I'm asking. It takes about 2 seconds. Of course, it is completely free to you, and it is the best possible way to support myself, the show, and everyone working on About Abroad behind the scenes. The funny thing is that there are thousands of people tuning in to this show every single week, but we are very likely to only get a few reviews by industry standards, and reviews are the most impactful way that you can show support for the show. So if you have the time, please do so. And either way, I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. I was hoping to circle back to Madeira a little bit because
absolutely,
you're calling this your home base. We're defining it that way at least, and I've been enamored with the work that's been going on there. We're both good friends with Gonzalo Hall, for example, who for anyone that doesn't know, like helped found the Digital Nomad Village there and Ponte do Sol, and was actually the reason that you and I were together there last year. And I mean, just the growth, the explosion in popularity that this little island sitting out in the Atlantic has come to be known as, sort of like a European Bali in a way or something like that. I don't know if that's the right definition, but anyway, I just find it fascinating that like this all feels like it happened relatively fast, as you've been there for several years now. Like, is that your perspective?
Absolutely. And I don't think that Gonzalo always gets enough credit. He was definitely the spark that got everything going. And I think what he did here and like getting it started was literally amazing. I said I didn't design to have this life and to be here. And the story of Madeira for me, or my connection to Madeira, is exactly that. I was in Crete spending the winter there, and I saw this news feed pop up, coming up and saying like, first digital nomad village in Madeira. And I was like, okay, I'll keep following it. And then before I knew it, I came over here. And that's a bit more of the advanced things. So one of the things that is missing in a lot of places is the community. And the community here is super strong, very active. You can literally do something every day. I could pop up, open Slack and look, okay, what's happening today? And when you work from home or remotely or traveling alone, that's a big thing sometimes, that you want to have interaction. And that's an amazing thing what's happened here from that perspective. I mean, what you have here is an island which is just absolutely stunning. It's relatively small. Infrastructure is great. You can easily access several points on the islands, and you have all those tunnels that connect you to places within, you know, 10 minutes. Doesn't really matter where you are. Probably the maximum you would travel is an hour, and you have nature, you have good weather, you have a community, you have good people. Prices are increasing like they are in pretty much everywhere in Europe. but it's still quite okay if you're coming remotely or if you have a remote job. It's a bit more tricky for the locals here today. That's becoming a bit of a challenge. But yeah.
Is that like a gentrification thing? Like just because so many foreigners are coming there now and it's like pushing the locals out a little bit?
Yes and no. Most of it, I have a bit of a different perspective on it because most of it is still in the hands of locals. What's happening is you are on an island and it's remote. It's more of a access to logistics, and logistics is quite expensive here. You can only access it by plane. You can only you cannot access it by train or by a boat or a ferry or something. That already makes things more expensive. So cost of living is higher here. I was in Lisbon and Porto last week, and supermarkets, food, restaurants, bars, cafe, quite a bit more affordable on the mainland than they are here. So that's just an issue. And then, of course, rent and property has become quite expensive here. But there are always walls like that. It was one of the most expensive hubs to buy in Portugal. But when you add it to the prices have gone up in Lisbon, and Madeira is the second highest city, so the second most expensive city, adds up when you have the increase and then you're still the second most expensive one as a reference. So that's become a bit of a challenge. But again, I have also grown up with everyone in Italy complaining. And when I was there for the summer, I was like, everyone is complaining, but we live so much better and we do so much more in South Italy than we do in Germany, where people technically make more money. So it's still happening here too.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I kind of hear this like everywhere, both when I like physically travel somewhere and or just like talking to people around the world. It's like, you could just fill in the blank with the location, and due to inflation and recovery from the pandemic and mass, you know, migrations and access to remote work. I mean, I can't tell you how many times like I've been told by somebody, "Oh yeah, the remote workers are killing our economy here, or they're pushing out the locals, or whatever it may be." And it's like it's actually such a small percentage of the impact in that specific regard. And more often than not, like it's feeding the economy much more than it is like damaging it in some way by pushing out locals. But it becomes a very easy thing to latch on to. I think this has been the case in Lisbon. Like so much of the focus has been on the remote workers, and the expats are driving the prices up and pushing locals out. And in reality, like when you look at the data, it's like such a small percentage of people. And it's mostly just like tourism and like a failure on the government's part to properly protect the locals from over mass tourism. So anyway, it's like an interesting thing to actually like dig, like once you get past the headlines and like actually look at the information that's available, it becomes very clear very quickly. But nonetheless, you see the mass media just latch on to those headlines that drive a lot of clicks.
It's 0.5% if the numbers are accurate. Right?
Yeah, less than 0.5%.
Golden visas and nomad visas in Portugal is 0.5%. So if 0.5% can have such a big impact, then the population can definitely have more impact. For me, what is challenging is the double standards. And for me, you just cannot have it both ways. You cannot say on one side, and I was having this conversation, I have lots of local friends. Most of my life here spent with local when I'm here. And it's like, oh, well, I have this apartment. It's worth something around 150, 200K max, but I'm going to sell it to one of you expats. Maybe it would be $500,000. And I'm like, you do know that, you know, this is one of the reasons why when the prices are going up. And you cannot complain on one side that expats are making this expensive when you want to cash in double the price of the worth, if that's the case. So it's always an interesting conversation. And as you said, when you look at the numbers are very interesting. We don't really lie.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, I mean, setting all that aside, it is such an incredible place to call home. I mean, you have pretty much year-round perfect weather, incredible access to nature, whether you like mountains and forests or you know, beaches and waves. Very cool, pretty international feeling little city there in Funchal. Lots of cute little towns around the coast, great food, super nice people I found. I mean, I was really kind of like blown away. Like I felt like, and I've heard this from several like perpetual digital nomads that have spent some time there, that like it would be a very easy place to call home. I've joked with Gonzalo that I would move there if I could just, as you, like you pointed this out with the logistics, if I could get there with my dog, I would come, but there's no ferry. There's no, you have to fly. And anyway, it's a half joke, but I mean, it's an incredible place. And I think the cherry on top, like is as you alluded to, the community. I mean, there are so many people living there and so much activity going on. You can find groups of people doing just about anything that you're interested in on like every single day.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's the best place I've been so far. It's very easy for me to call home. You have this best of all worlds. The nature here is incredible. I mean, tell me one place in the world where you have a relatively big city on one end. You are in a European culture and environment, a European Union. You can be at the beach with 25 degrees and half an hour you can be in the snow with like a few degrees. You can be in nature, you can be in a city, you can be by the beach. Like these are all amazing things for me. But then you have a European culture, food is great, people are great, you have the community, it's very easy to get around here. Almost everyone speaks English. The government is doing programs for you to learn Portuguese as well that you can access for free almost anywhere on the island. Definitely a few parts that I know are doing that. You have the nomad community and you have good weather all year round. So, definitely more pluses than negatives. And for me, the geographical isolation works really well because I'm a public speaker, because I do a lot of speaking engagements. Being a little bit away makes me stay here longer and not wanting to join. It's almost like a natural barrier. But like, yeah, I could come and do the speaking engagement, but I'm 7 hours, 8 hours flight away because I have to take two flights. And that will align you to having to be a bit more picky and choosing it. So that works for me really well on top of it. And yeah, so it's best of both worlds for me.
Is there anything that hasn't met your expectations about living in Madeira or maybe it's Portugal in general?
Ooh, it's a tricky one. So I grew up in Germany, so I always have the inner German in me. Look, there are lots of things that could be better, but that's like anywhere. There are so many other alternatives. If you don't like it, you can also go somewhere else. You could complain, for example, that infrastructure in terms of public transport could be better. But this is a small, remote island. One thing that for me is the worst in terms of here, that we don't really have Bolt and Uber. My understanding, there was a law to prevent the numbers of Bolts and Ubers that you have here. From my perspective, that a little bit drives up the drink and drive because it's very hard to get an Uber at night. And you take a taxi, you want to go somewhere else that will cost you. And even there, you don't have capacity. You have to wait. That could be something that I was in Porto. Whenever I'm in Porto in Lisbon, I'm so amazed how easy it is to get around with Ubers and Bolts there. They are more affordable than here on the island. They are maybe a third of the price I would pay here, if not more. That's a bit of an easy negative one, if you want. You could have more international food variety. That's a bit limited. But then again, that's not really a massive problem for me because I come in and out. So that's okay for me. And it's not a problem for most locals. I mean, this island up to before nomads and young travelers that are, because it's not only nomads, it's also young tourists that come here to go and experience adventure, to go into nature, a bit more active tourists. So that's also changing per se. Maybe 10 years ago, most of the tourists coming here were 50, 60 plus, mainly coming from the Netherlands, from Germany, from England, a little bit from the States, didn't really care about having a variety of international food. We're coming here for 7 days, so it's not that big. Now that you have more healthy, active tourists coming in, plus remote workers and nomads, that maybe is changing a bit. And there could be more variety. But again, we're being very, very, very picky now.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating to watch grow. I mean, the rocket ship has taken off, and it's a popular place already. I hear people from all corners of the world talking about this little island, this little Portuguese island out in the Atlantic. So doing something right, the praise is warranted. I think it's kind of interesting, like someone like yourself, you know, you identify as, you know, your other home, I guess, or a home that you've had in your life being in Puglia in Italy, which is just such an incredible destination in and of itself. Maybe in some ways, like when you know, Italy it needs no introduction and is well established on the map. It's probably one of those top few places in the world that people think of first when they start traveling and going off to experience some new place. But I think within Italy, Puglia is like one of those areas that just made its entrance as of recently and become an international destination in and of itself. So maybe after someone's seen, you know, Rome and Venice or Florence or something like that, they start looking for that next tier. And I hear Apulia popping up more and more. It's one of my favorite regions in all of Italy. And I think for good reason. In my opinion, what it has, though, is it kind of has like everything that some of those other more like popular destinations have, but without the over-tourism and still retaining all the, probably more so retaining the like authentic culture. For anyone who's unfamiliar what we're talking about, it's like the heel of the boot is the way that I describe it. But maybe you as a local have a better way. But is your perspective similar to mine, or do you kind of have a different vantage point?
Yeah, spot on. I think there are a few things that come together there. And the heel of the boot is definitely the best way of describing it. That's the easiest way to get around it. What Puglia has is Puglia has always been a destination for August for Italians mainly to go and have holidays there. So it's always been on the map for Italians. The beaches are incredible, especially if you go down to the south of Puglia. You have, it's always been called the Caribbean of Europe. And that's amazing. What you don't really have at the moment is that mindset of this can be a place for the whole year. And I think that's one of those areas of growth. The other thing is it's very beach seasonal areas. And then you have some of the biggest cities where people live. And for me, it's one of the hidden gems and missed opportunities so far. If with all the things that are happening at the moment, with all the nomad visas and everything, and the return of the brain, how they call it in Italy, this movement to make Italians come back to Italy, and all the incentives that there are there on housing, on living, on construction and renovations, on taxes. If they nail that bureaucracy, that is an absolute gem to live in. And what it has so far is it's still very natural, still very raw and rural in some ways too, but like raw. You don't have that touristy vibe that you have when you go and you visit some other places. Like I love Rome, for example, but you know you are in a touristic place. You go to South Italy, and if you're not there in August, you don't know that this is a very famous place. And especially what is one massive opportunity is because the cities and towns are dying, and there is an aging population problem. Remote work, nomadism, short-term stay could really be the answer to repopulate some of those areas. And there are some small initiatives starting, but it's way there's so much demand. I can share an example. I was there last year in August, end of August, and I was in my dad's town, and I loved it. You can literally eat figs from the tree, really as fresh as it gets. And fruit and vegetable, everything is so fresh. And I remember it was the last weekend of August, and all the young people were leaving to go back to the cities in the north to go where we spent 11 months a year and work. And overnight, almost overnight, the city became 20, 25, 30 years older. Because the only people that stayed back were the parents that lived there.
Wow. Yeah, that's a, I think there's so much opportunity there. I know we were talking a little bit before we started recording. You're working on some things with the government there, which are still in the infancy stages, but I think any impact you can have to help bring more people to that area, they won't be disappointed. I was shocked when I went to, like, for example, Lecce, and to learn that like Lecce is referred to as like the Florence of the South, for example. And it like never has a name, like a nickname meant like resonated so obviously. Like once I got there, I was like, oh yeah, it feels like that. But again, like I was just in Florence a couple months ago, and it's like walking through Disney World, especially during the summer. I mean, it's just hordes of tourists, and as beautiful of the city as it is, you feel like you're in line everywhere to do everything because there's so many people in the streets, and in a place like Lecce where you have almost like the same vibe and you know, aesthetically it seems very similar. Like you have a lot of the same sort of things going on, except you just remove like 80% of the people. And it's very cool. Very cool thing.
And it's ironic for me. You have a town 10 minutes from Lecce who has just announced some funds to have people come and move in. They want young people and families. And they will give you up to 30,000 euros, up to 60% of the value, right, to go and move there. And you look at the pricing of the houses, and with 50,000 euros, you can buy a decent home, you know? And you get 30,000 back. You go like, okay, you can buy a massive property. If you spend the equivalent of what you would buy in Madeira, you could buy 6 apartments there if you want to. So it's definitely a push there. And it's just a beautiful place. I mean, historically, that's in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. So you have so much influence that even within a few kilometers, the cities are completely different. So you have cities that resemble Santorini in Greece. And then 5 minutes later, you have a city which is more Nordic, right? And you will have a castle which feels like it doesn't fit there. And then you drive half an hour and you have this weirdly cone-shaped houses in the Trullis. And you go like, how is this all within the same region? And even food-wise, the food that we eat at my mom's place, which is close to Bari in Andria, which is the northern part of Puglia, and the food that we eat at my dad's place, which is more close to Brindisi and Lecce, is completely different because it's just so much influence from different parts.
It's so cool. Yeah, it's a beautiful part of the world. I highly recommend it to people. Like if someone asks me, like they're I want to make a trip to Italy. I've done Rome and Venice, you know, or something like that. Like, where should I go next? That's like top of my list. The other place that I'm starting to mention to people is like where I am up, like currently up in the Dolomites, because as popular as the word the Dolomites is, it's not an unknown, you know, destination by any means. But I do think it's a bit still like very largely undiscovered and on that like second, third, fourth tier of places that people might go. It's not super easy to get to. There's not like a city that people can really identify with as like the place to go. It's just like Dolomites. Okay, what is that? But once you get to know the area a little bit, you can start making some recommendations. And I think they're at like opposite ends of the country. But you know, that's the cool, very cool thing about Italy is you can get, you know, the Alps on one end and some of the most incredible beaches and warm Mediterranean type weather on the other, and you don't even have to leave the borders of this country.
And one of the things, and I can connect it also with some of the work I'm doing now, is some of the things that happens also in Italy is that you're always 20 minutes away from something spectacular. So, you know, you take Puglia, you take any other region, really, take a big city, you took Florence. I'm sure there's a town 20 minutes away from Florence where life is very affordable. It's very non-touristy and you can set roots there and you're still 20 minutes away from Florence. And the same happens everywhere. It happens in Sicily, happens in Puglia, happens in Sardinia, happens in the Dolomites in North Italy. It really happens everywhere. I saw one of my friends tag me. It was a three-bedroom apartment for 12,000 euros being sold an hour away from Rome. Now, tell me any other country where you can do that, where you can go an hour away from Lisbon or an hour away from New York or an hour away from DC or London, where you can find immaculate towns that you can buy and you could afford living, and you are away 1 hour away from one of the most amazing places.
It's tough to find, and yet once you discover it, it's a magical thing that I really appreciate. So I'm glad you found your home away from home. You have another beautiful home back where your bloodlines flow to, and I think, like, you know, it's an awesome life that you've built for yourself. We didn't even really get to like talk about all the things you're doing professionally. We might have to save that for a follow-up episode, but you're also doing some, you know, incredible things, writing books, speaking around the world, leading a pretty revolutionary company and helping other companies adapt to the future of work. So I feel like we could go on and on about that stuff, but we'll make sure to place links in the show notes to so people can access that and learn more about you in that way.
I can maybe give us a bit of a lens into my mindset and world there. What's been driving me forever is creating better tomorrows. I see this big opportunity in the fraction between work and life. So work still populates most of our life. For a lot of us, we have a very busy work life, and that dictates what kind of life we can have. And for years, I've been trying to help people. So I usually start working with people at the work side, and then it transitions into looking at the work life part of it. And I think this is what been driving me for the last couple of years, and this is how I've got most of my projects on the go. So one of them in Puglia at the moment, it's been 3 years that I'm back in Europe, a little over that. And all the time, whenever I mention Puglia, people tell me like, oh, I would love to be able to go there. I would love to buy there. I would love to spend some time there. So last year, I actually spent quite a bit of time there, and I saw how bad things are in terms of aging population. And it really convinced me that maybe it's time to start looking into it. So I just did what I do best. I started talking to a few people. One of them is my uncle. And I said, who could I talk to if I wanted to get nomads? I have so many nomads telling me they want to come to Italy. And he's like, well, I can connect you with a couple of the mayors there. So I started talking with the mayors and to see what kind of projects we could do to attract nomads. And they're all super open because for them, young people, yes, of course, come over. And that's how I started writing my book. That's how I started speaking around the world. And that's how I do most of the things I do.
Who you know, not what you know, still exists even today. I feel like sometimes, fortunately, in your situation, you happen to know a lot about the subject too. So it makes it a double-edged sword. But I think it's fantastic, and like I can see a lot of benefit there. So I hope that, you know, I hope to see the development in that space really pay off, because I think it could be great for the locals. I think it could be great for travelers who want to spend more time in a beautiful, still somewhat undiscovered part of the world, in one of the most popular countries in the world. So
it's both. So for me, it's knowing your stuff. So you have to be really good at what you do, and you have to strive to be the best of the best in your category. And then on top of that, more than knowing people is just having conversations and listening. So, you know, we didn't know each other. We just happened to be at a lunch where we were both participating in a conference. We had a good conversation, and from there all started. But besides that, you know, you're good at what you do. So it makes it easy for me to want to hang out with you and have those conversations. If you have a bad conversation, and you know, you can know people, but it doesn't mean that it goes anywhere. But you, generically speaking, if you have a good conversation with someone, it keeps interest. And we connected quite naturally. We stayed in touch via LinkedIn, and here we are a year or so later. So, you know, it's both sides. You got to be good at what you do, but you also have to have conversations.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think one of the funny things is, like, as we live in this more like digital virtual first world, and a lot of the ways that we're working, that can be the art of conversation, and also like the act of listening, being a good listener and feeling out pain points for people, and also like reading body language and things like that can sometimes be sort of lost. And I know that you and I are both involved in work day to day that helps people overcome those challenges in the virtual world. So it's they're still very important skills, and they pay dividends if you invest in them. But I think one of the misnomers is that you give all that up, or you lose all that when you go to a remote model at a you know, on a company level, or in terms of like your personal work. And fortunately for you and I, we know that we can retain those things. There's still a place for it.
And there is, I mean, we talk about future of work, remote is definitely there. One of the things that excites me is to see some more advanced companies like yours. You do still face-to-face retreats, get-togethers. And we as humans, I'm fully committed to it. We need that human interaction. So what do nomads do that work alone and don't have opportunities to connect with other people at work? We go out and we live in communities like Madeira, where we have, you know, a couple of different types of communities across the island to connect with people and to have that human interaction.
That's an awesome way to wrap this thing up. Dom, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. I'm glad that we were finally able to make this happen. Appreciate you making the time and for sharing your story with me and with the audience. While people are still listening, where can people go to learn more about you and your work and everything that you're doing? We'll place those links in the show notes.
Perfect. I think the number one thing is LinkedIn. That's where I'm most active. That would be the go-to if you want to reach out to me via LinkedIn. That's the easiest way. Then from a corporate perspective, from a company perspective, the Great Shift website. So it's just great-shift.com. The book is available on Amazon as an ebook, also as a paperback book that you can buy. All countries where Amazon is represented. And of course, I do online workshops and coaching and mentoring. So if that's your thing, reach out. And I usually work with founders, freelancers, people that want to make a transition into work life and working, wanting to living and working differently. That's who I work with these days. And you can always join a retreat or something where we can work on that.
He's one of the best in the world at it. So I can also highly recommend that. And please do also check out the book. Again, links will be in the show notes for anyone interested. Thank you again, Dom. Hope to see you soon. If not in Madeira, somewhere around the world.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chase. And thanks for the opportunity. I really enjoyed sharing some.
Me as well. Me as well. Obrigado and grazie and danke and all of the above.
Prego. Prego.
Thanks for tuning in today from wherever you are in the world. Once again, I'm Chase, and this has been another episode of About Abroad. For those of you wondering how you can best support the show, I have made it super simple for you. Just go over to the show notes of the episode that you just finished listening to and click on one of the two following links. aboutabroad.com/newsletter to get our monthly newsletter, no spam, guaranteed. Or ratethispodcast.com/aboutabroad, where you can quickly and easily leave a review for the show. It's not just important to me, it also helps more wanderers just like you find us. Finally, don't forget to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice, and we will see you again next week. Thanks again. Hasta luego, amigos.